KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, writer Dave Eggers' newest novel follows foreign aid workers constructing a road through an unnamed developing country. In Eggers' telling, it can be morally disconnected and morally ambiguous work.
All these people are dropped in and build something that might last centuries or might change drastically the lives of hundreds of thousands or millions of people, and then the people that built these things are gone.
Eggers joins us to discuss his novel, The Parade, and what he thinks of the effectiveness and ethics of international development. We'll also talk to Dave Eggers about his experience at a recent Trump rally and why he thinks Trump may be reelected. It's all next after this news. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Dave Eggers' newest novel, The Parade, follows the construction of a road through an unidentified developing country that is recovering from a recent civil war. Written in spare prose and with few identifying details about location and characters, the book becomes a parable of the moral complexities underlying international aid efforts. Dave Eggers is the founder of the San Francisco-based publishing house McSweeney's and co-founder of A26 National, a network of youth, writing, and tutoring centers. His many books include A Hologram for the King, The Circle, and A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, and he joins us this hour to talk about The Parade and questions it raises about the ethics of well-intentioned development projects, and we'll talk about more with him as well, and welcome back to Forum.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Always good to have you. Thank you for being here. I guess I want to begin, before we talk about your novel, which I'm quite high on, by talking about something I read that you did in The Guardian. You were down in El Paso, and you were attending a Trump rally and also a Beto O'Rourke rally, and you came to a conclusion that many people would find very interesting. Before I get to that, though, serve as a little bit of a tease, I want to get to the fact that you were writing about not only experiencing the rally, the Trump rally, with all the mega hats and all the rest of it, but you were certainly writing about people who were living there on the border, which Trump now wants to close down. And we're talking about $1.7 billion in commerce a day at that border, lots of jobs and so forth. A lot of these people were very gung-ho Trump, about 40% of them minorities, a lot of them Chicano people, Latinos. And the reality is, what do you think these people are feeling now that Trump is threatening to close down the border?
People in El Paso and people that actually live on the border have very nuanced views that are sort of – and very practical views, I guess, about the border. I interviewed a lot of people that actually go to and from every day, like truckers, for example. And I interviewed a guy that was a trucker. He just delivers furniture, delivers everything. He's freelance. And he goes back and forth, you know, sometimes 3-4 times a day. And obviously, all of that inner country commerce would shut down. The economy of El Paso would be obliterated. The economies of so many border towns would grind to a halt. Obviously, the auto industry would grind to a halt. And so it's an insane idea, completely impractical. I think it's not anything new to us that we're hearing an impractical.
And insane ideas?
An insane idea coming from the White House. But it was amazing to be there because I toggled between the two rallies all day interviewing people. And the Trump audience was about 17,000. And the Beto O'Rourke audience was maybe 3,000. And both crowds were wildly diverse and really reflective of how diverse El Paso is, because El Paso is about 80% Latino. And it was amazing to actually interview people and hear just how sort of practical they come at their support of Trump, which is really about the economy. Everyone I met was like, well, the economy is doing well. My wages are up. I lost a job. I got a job the next day. And that's sort of most of it. But then also talking to Mexican-American men, women, grandfathers, grandmothers, talking about how they came over and how they look at immigration, which is like a lot of supporters of Trump are Mexican Americans that came over or their grandparents came over, and they look to him to provide some kind of, I don't know, order, I guess, at the border. I was so here in San Francisco where we have a different idea of everything. We're in a bubble. And then to hear everybody provide like very practical plans and say, well, we want there to be a plan. We want there to be order. We don't want people to jump the line. All these different things, but then also hear how funny everybody is about the idea of a wall.
And they were saying complete the wall, right? They were saying, and they hadn't even started the wall.
What was so funny is that these signs, because Trump's propagandists are kind of brilliant, he hasn't started the wall, but they had given out signs to everybody in the audience that said, finish the wall. So suddenly it was like 10,000 signs that say, finish the wall. And it was this amazing kind of, Jedi mind trick, you know, to sort of say, like, it hasn't started, but suddenly in everyone's mind, it was just about done. And all we have to do is, like, finish it. So I thought, you know, his supporters are very, I think, malleable sometimes about their ideas about these things. But at the same time, I love going to these rallies, and I've been to other rallies, because most of the people you interview are incredibly sane, are very practical in why they support him. And they're not listening to every little thing and every tweet. None of them. I never meet anybody that cares about every last outrageous thing he says. But I came away thinking he's going to be formidable in 2020, because his support has a much wider base of support than we think.
You even suggested or intimated there might be a dynasty, because you thought that Don Jr. had some charisma and came across pretty well. But I want to go back to the wall with you. You saw some wall samples when you were down in San Diego in Mexico, and this was pretty enlightening. I mean, it was also, I think you described it as surreal and disturbing.
Well, it was a little bit of Burning Man, a little bit of like a site-specific art project, you know, to see these five giant samples in the San Diego desert. And I got a tour with Homeland Security and press tour maybe a year ago. And it was obviously a monument to one person's vanity and impractical ideas and understanding of the border. Because, again, the wall, there are tunnels all over the border. Most of these walls would be easily scaled. The walls, there's already a wall in El Paso. There's a wall that runs through the entire city, and which is also easily breached. I mean, you put up a ladder. I sat at this one wall, part of the wall. I didn't see a police officer or any sort of border control for miles. And to get over this wall would take anybody 30 seconds.
We had Janet Napolitano on yesterday in the second hour, and, you know, she had former governor of New Mexico who said, all you need is a ladder, a ladder of the right height. All it takes.
It's about 14 feet high. Just lean a ladder up, and you'd be over in seconds. And so his understanding is so crude and so childish in a way, not to insult children that way, but I saw these samples they had just been put up, and what was amazing was that they told us, all the border control officers were very open, very candid, and you could interview anybody you wanted to and photograph anything you wanted to, but they said, don't photograph the contractors. They don't want to have their picture taken or be interviewed. So all these, you know, construction companies had built these samples.
What a great segue to your novel.
Well, it struck me because I was finishing the book at that point, and I thought it's the perfect corollary, because these contractors didn't want to be caught up in the politics and the debate about the wall or whether we should build it or not or what it meant to anybody. So they were happy to build the wall and take their millions or whatever they got paid for each sample. But they didn't want to be held personally responsible, or the workers on the ground didn't want to be implicated in the consequences of it or the implications of the wall's samples. And so I thought that was fascinating, because I'm interested in who are these workers, you know, who are these just contractors who are paid to carry out plans that they have no distinct interest in or no sort of dog in that fight, and sort of what goes on in their minds. And, you know, that's where the parade started.
Well, the parade has two workers who have only numbers as names, 4 and 9, and who have no passports, come in by charter plane. We don't know what the machine company they work for is. We don't know if there's not even any serial number on that. I mean, there's a real sense of they're cloaking themselves in anonymity. And yet, let me tell you something that struck me in this. The characters are so different. I mean, obviously you designed it that way. They're yin and yang. It's a duality. It's really binary almost. I mean, one is very much by the rules, protocol, the clock type of guy. He goes by the clock in every way. And the other one, transgressive and drinking and wanting to meet the locals and get involved in their lives and so forth, going to prostitutes and so forth and so on. I mean, completely opposites. And I was thinking, I must confess, I'm not going to give any spoilers here, but I was thinking, this is after a civil war. Maybe their duality reflects a kind of civil war because there's a lot of tension between them. And like I said, I don't want to take it too far here. But what I was particularly struck by was, this is going to sound strange to you, but being a literary guy, seeing a Toni Morrison's novel, Sula, because there's a character named Jude, and he says, I want to be in that road. I want to be a worker to be part of that road. We didn't really get that sense of these guys. They were just there to do the job, and they were completely amoral about it, really.
Well, the first guy, Four, is nicknamed the Clock, and he really has done infrastructure projects like this all over the world. So he goes in and gets the project done, paving a road, basically. Wherever he is, he doesn't matter. It's to him, the local politics don't matter to him. He's there to do it as quickly as possible and get out. And Nine is new to this work. And he actually dives in and takes an interest and thinks, you know what? He comes to believe that they're doing a really great thing by connecting these two parts of the country where there weren't roads before. And that might lead to access to medicine, access to, you know, more goods and services for, you know, the more rural and disconnected part of the country. So he becomes a true believer and kind of very engaged. And anytime he sees anyone that, you know, he thinks he's needed everywhere, you know, and so he becomes deeply involved with everyone that they pass while paving this road.
I'm just wondering, are you more in sympathy with him? Because he's also a screw-up, big time.
Yeah, everything he touches ends up sort of more messed up than when he first encountered it. But, yeah, I identify a little bit or a lot with Nine, with the guy that just is, you know, an bleeding heart, open, you know, minded, wanting to engage, seeing people and wanting to get to know them.
And so is chaos.
And so he's so reckless and incautious and sort of naive. And he doesn't know anything about the local politics. And he certainly doesn't know anything about the implications of the work that they're doing. And so I wanted both characters to have so much that you can sort of identify with, and you might see yourself in a little bit in both of them, but ultimately there's a plan that's much larger than both of them even are aware of. So they're both pawns in a way, even though we think they are somewhat in control. And it's funny because, you know, these guys aren't from the United States. They're not from, I wanted it to be unnamed because in the U.S. we always assume this is about American intervention. And whatever we touch, we sort of screw up and sort of were and are sort of imperialistic impulses. But
come on, contractors are for hire from wherever nation they're with. Yeah.
I mean, this started, you know, back in 2006, I was in South Sudan, in a very disconnected part of South Sudan, and I saw a road being paved. And I saw, you know, all this machinery, and it was a Swedish team. So these, you know, small Swedish team had come to South Sudan to pave a road. And I thought that was the first indicator or the first sort of catalyst for the book was I thought, how odd, you know, that the South Sudanese, it was the government of Khartoum that had hired these guys.
When you were with Valentine Deng?
Yeah, I was with Valentino Deng, and we were working on building the school that he built in his hometown. And we were looking at other sites around. So this was near Awil, which is in South Sudan. And we saw this massive highway being built, like maybe six lanes, through absolute pastoral, you know, rural areas, obliterating any homes that they encountered along the way. But it was a Swedish team, which was so interesting in so many ways, because they certainly could have gone to a Kenyan paving company or Ugandan paving company if they didn't have the expertise themselves. But bringing in these Scandinavian road pavers, it had so many implications because I think that purposely they wanted, you know, a very foreign and politically disconnected body to come in and do that work so that there were no sort of, I don't know, political problems or sort of opinions to be had about the conflict or the implications of the road. And so I thought, because, you know, any country coming out of a civil war like South Sudan was, a road, it could bring progress and it could bring great things, but it also could facilitate more evil in a lot of ways, you know, especially with an oppressive government like that of Khartoum. So it started me thinking about this, and then I kept seeing similar projects in other parts of the world. In particular, the Chinese are everywhere now with their Belt and Road project.
So you wanted to make it universal. You didn't want to—I mean, because you could have said Sudan and you could have said Scandinavian workers, but chose not to.
Yeah, but it's the same everywhere, this soft power, sort of economic imperialism in a way. But it's not just that. It's also so often the local government that brings in these contractors has a design or a motive that is sometimes elusive or invisible to those executing the work.
And as clock-like as Four is, at one point he uses the word sublime about the road. I mean, there is a sense of not only building this road, but that it can do something, that it has aesthetics to it, maybe even more than the job. And one of the big surprises for me, again, this is just a tease, I'm not giving any spoiler here, is what we find out he's listening to on his headphones while driving around in the machine, in the big machine. Big surprises, and a very intricate pot in so many ways. I want to talk about a couple things specifically with you, though, because there's also an honest man, a man who we call Medallion, or you call Medallion, because he has a medallion on him. And in a place that's so rife with bribery and with corruption and, you know, with violence and people being held hostage, and we always realize that those are imminent, mines in the forest and so forth. This is a really decent, hardworking man. What he wants to do is he wants a correspondence course from a university. He wants an education.
Yeah. Well, that actually was based on a man who was a regional commander I met in South Sudan who used to be part of the rebel army, the SPLA. And he was, showed us around him. And you meet sort of middlemen everywhere, you know, when you're doing sort of any sort of project in a developing country. And sometimes
his wife raped, I have to ask?
Because, no. This,
because there's so much of that as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's mentioned as a tool of war, that had happened in this country for many years, which of course happened in South Sudan, continues to happen in Congo. And but in this case, this regional commander who I got to know really well, he said, because everyone in a place like South Sudan, especially back in 2006, there's so much need on so many levels. Like, can you connect us with an NGO that might build a clinic near here? And, you know, they see visitors as a lever to change, you know, and maybe we can help connect them to services that they need, whether it's a tractor or whether it's a clinic or mosquito nets. But this commander who I got to know really well, he said, you know what I really want is can you cook me up with a correspondence course, because I want to get an associate's degree from a U.S. university. And I ended up sending him a box of materials, you know. I mean, this was before online correspondence courses were so popular. But it struck me just that you can never assume anyone's sort of most dearest desires, you know, and what they really want most of all. And but Medallion, you know, has a little bit of this regional commander in him. But he offers his help because he sees the road as a inherent good. And he has a very sick wife who can only get help if she's able to get to the capital in the north of the country. And so the minute the road is finished, he knows he can transport his wife to the capital and finally she might get better. And so he becomes a help all the way through to the pavers. And he's naive too. He just wants to believe. He has a purity of heart, you know, even despite all that he's seen in, you know, decades of war. And so, you know, Medallion is the heart of the book, really, and sort of the person that I, that I think that we're allowed to believe in.
Very compelling character. Yeah. And on the other side, there's this woman who's running a clinic who... I mean, you would think would be full of humanity and all the rest of it, but the way you portray her is almost just the antithesis.
Well, she's a Westerner or an outsider who's running a clinic, a rural clinic that has a very narrow mission to sort of...
reproductive stuff for indigenous people.
Yeah. Right. And so when Nine, one of the two pavers, gets very sick, she sees it outside of her purview to help him. She doesn't want to be a babysitter or a nurse to foreign contractors. And so there's a little bit of a an inversion, I guess. She has compassion for the people that she's tasked with serving and really no compassion whatsoever for these foreign contractors, which I've seen many times. You know, you see this in
she talks about her corporate or their corporate overlords,
yeah.
Overlords, and she wears a shirt that says kelp on it, which
yeah.
I was struck by as well.
Yeah, I wanted, in every case, I wanted every character to sort of defy expectations, because when you are, you know, among NGO workers, which I've spent a lot of time among them and traveling with them, there's every kind of person. It's not all, you know, the most by the book or purity of heart sort of, you know, you see all kinds of motivations and all kinds of ways to execute their work. And I wanted her to have that same kind of complexity. And also, you know, defying what we assume would be her Hippocratic oath. But at the same time, Nine, through his recklessness, put himself in this position, made, you know, defied all of the rules and got very sick as a result. And so she has no sympathy for that when she's trying to help the most needy people that she's, you know, among.
Our guest is Dave Eggers, and we're talking to him about his latest novel, The Parade. Have you been involved, any of you? I'm talking to listeners now in international development projects. You might want to let us know about your experiences, particularly things that may have surprised you. And you may simply want to weigh in here and join this conversation. And if so, we cordially invite you to do that. We're also talking about, we started out talking about a piece that Dave did for The Guardian where he said, yes, Trump could win again in 2020. There are many enthusiastic supporters out there, and many of them are people who are not necessarily those you would expect living here in San Francisco and the Bay Area to be supporters. So please feel free to join us with your thoughts and with any questions or comments you might have. You can do that now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, and email us any questions or comments you might have, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And we do want to hear from you, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, Dave Eggers' new book is called The Parade. He is the founder of McSweeney's and 826 Valencia, and we welcome your involvement in the program. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Dave Eggers, author of The Parade, his newest novel. He's also founder of McSweeney's and 826 Valencia, and you are certainly welcome to join the program. Welcome your calls and emails. Again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email forum@kqed.org. Here's Nigel, who writes, I wonder if Dave Eggers has read the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, in which aid is portrayed as a tool to ensnare poor countries with vast unpayable debts.
Mm. No, I haven't, but obviously that's
a viable thesis.
A viable thesis, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, in this case, I don't want to confuse The Parade with those sorts of projects, because in this case, these contractors were hired by the local government, and they are tools of that government. And so it's I wanted to be sure that it didn't fit into that rubric of American soft power or economic imperialism or the modern version that's being executed by China of the more powerful omnipotent sort of global power having designs on the resources of a country. that has no choice almost but to accept their help. And but in this case, I wanted to be, you know, us to be sure that in this case the contractors are being used for purposes beyond their imagining, I guess, and the motivations and the power really lies in actually that local government that has designs on them, and on their project and is going to use it for purposes that I have trouble like actually explaining some of this because I don't want to give away everything, but yeah, I think that I wanted it to defy sort of this sort of this dynamic that we're so used to, which is that our interference or our help, whether it's on the NGO level or the government level, is always fraught, which it is, and that we are always have ulterior or
we're always culpable somehow.
Yeah. In this case, it's actually we have to give the power to the local commissioning government here and say that we are not always the source of all sort of intended or unintended evil. You know, in this case, the power lies elsewhere. And so I don't want it to sort of, you know, it to fall too easily into that sort of expected paradigm.
You're very careful in kind of framing it the way you just did. And I think it's safe to say you're also careful and very controlled in the use of prose in this novel. I mean, for someone who's often been associated with a much more exuberant stylistics, you are becoming maybe a little bit more like Sam Beckett here or something along those lines.
You know, in this, I think every story has an appropriate style and tone, and this one lent itself to a more minimalistic prose style, and I felt like there's an exuberance sometimes in how Nine expresses himself and how he sees the world, but it's because this is third person and because it's really just about I wanted it to be as tense as the relationship between the two of them and the relationship to the work they're doing and the larger context. And so any extra word would get in the way of that. And it's weird at this point, you know, maybe 19 years after I wrote my first book to have, yeah, strayed so far, I guess, from that sort of maximalist style of that first book.
It's a metamorphosis, maybe, and it's a different book. And plus, yeah. I was also thinking about Wendela, your wife. I mean, she writes a very spare kind of style often.
Yeah.
That may be cross-fertilizing.
Yeah, maybe I'm just I'm copying Wendela because, you know, her prose style is so brilliantly developed, more so than, and I think I'm more malleable, and she's been she inevitably is an influence, and because she's a pro stylist, and I think I'm sometimes a little bit chameleonic, I guess, but the story, I always feel like whatever that story is demands a certain kind of telling, and I'm happy to follow it and try to be invisible in that telling. You know, I don't want the prose style to overwhelm the story itself. And so it's sometimes fun to sort of meld the exact right sort of tone and delivery to that story. And it was fun to sort of control it just so tautly in this case.
It's funny. It's often associated more with writers like Raymond Carver and Ernest Hemingway, that nominal style. And yet, Wendela's work is often stylistically compared to Joan Didion. I mean, maybe there's a gender gap there, too.
No, we're both huge Joan Didion acolytes, and I think that I think she's the, you know, one of the great American prose stylists, you know, that we've produced. I mean, definitely a top few in my book. And but she was definitely an influence here in her novels. And Conrad was an influence of hers, and in particular Victory, which is a book that she always referenced and talked about reading repeatedly. And one of the things that Didion said somewhere was that she often sought to write a book that could be read in one sitting, and that was a successful book in her mind, and that Victory was that like that for her. And so it always stuck with me, and so this book is a shorter novel, but I think that there's something
You can read it in one setting.
Yeah.
And that's what Poe said a short story should be. You know, to sit at one, just read it through and so forth, that the novel can't do, because novels are usually much longer. But this is a what used to be called maybe a novella or something.
Well, you know, but if you think about, we've gotten so length obsessed here. Like, novels in the U.S. have to be 900 pages or something to be, to be considered a novel. But if you look back at so many books that we cherish, whether it's Great Gatsby, which is about 150 pages, really, to, I don't know, Animal Farm, to there's so many classics that were quite short. And it's just as, in general, you know, we would never call Great Gatsby a novella. But if it were published today, it probably would be, because of how our perceptions of what constitutes a full novel have changed. But so I think novella is a kind of a damning term now.
It's an archaic term, really.
Yeah, it's too
bad. You know, they also use it called novelettes. You remember that?
Yeah,
novelettes.
That's terrible.
Like a long short story was a novelette. Here's Ashish joining us from Fremont. Ashish, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had one comment that. So I disagree a little bit of the effectiveness of the border barriers, because the data shows that wherever the border fences were put up, the levels of illegal immigration came down significantly. And now, especially now, this the San Diego border fence that is stopping tens of thousands of illegal immigrants from crossing over. And if not for that wall, San Diego would become another Honduras or Guatemala. So that is one thing. And quickly, another point is that one reason the contractors don't want to come forward publicly is that they fear the so-called left-wing mob, because some of the left-wing advocacy groups are very aggressive, very vicious, and they call for boycotts of individuals and organizations that disagree with them. So those are the couple of points I wanted to make.
Well, thank you. I have to mention Fremont. I was in Fremont a few weeks ago for a Tulsi Gabbard election event, which was really, you know, I had a great time in Fremont. And there was also that day a memorial for the victims of the mosque attacks in New Zealand. So that followed it immediately. But I just on a side note, but the Tulsi Gabbard, I'm following election as much as I can. I've been writing about it. And this is such an amazing moment when there's 20-odd candidates or something. Like, I don't know if anything has compared to it in our lifetime, with so many candidates and so many fascinating candidates. And Tulsi Gabbard, I saw her speak at it was called Bronco Billy's Pizza Palace in Fremont, in a mini mall in Fremont.
I love the way you keep your pro roots, you know, going places that are right in concert with that. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I came into it a little bit cynically, and thinking like, well, this is, she's at one point considered a rising star of the Democratic Party, even though she had some unusual moves in her background, including meeting with Assad in Syria. But I came away feeling like it was really democracy at its best, you know, like retail politics, this, you know, candidate speaking in a very incongruous and not very fancy place, you know. But the questions were really interesting. the passion there was real. And I wish that we could just maintain that beautiful kind of egalitarian aspect of democratic politics that exists right now. And then we sort of start to lose it as we get closer and to the primary and afterward, when it becomes much more about consolidation of power and money and all that. But right now, anyway, that was my recent Fremont memory. I had a great time over there, but I thank you for the call.
Well, thanks for the call indeed. And apropos of that, let me read a comment from Stephen and get your response. Stephen writes, Dave and Michael both said that here in the Bay Area, we're in a bubble. I have to disagree. I think we're in a zone of truth. The people swallowing Trump's propaganda are the ones in a bubble.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. But you know what? I think we have to really listen. There's no greater critic. I mean, there's nobody that I can't stand Trump. And I've been very open about that for years and years. But I started by going to a Trump rally in August of 2016 up in Sacramento. And I thought, this was before this is while nobody thought he could possibly win. So I thought, I went to it as a curiosity, thinking, this is a ludicrous moment in our history, and I've got to witness it. But I came away again that day because the audience was diverse, the audience was very reasonable. They sort of looked like they were the same audience that would go to a baseball game or a 4th of July picnic. And I thought, wow, his base of support is much wider than I would think and much more reasonable. These are not a bunch of like frothing, you know, white supremacists everywhere in the audience. They're attracted.
In fact, there are people who probably are very angry at that kind of stereotyping that
right.
goes on because they're Trump supporters.
Right. Yeah. And so they're very defensive about it. And so I think that there are those supporters. I think we just have to very carefully and we have to listen to why. I think these rallies are so important to go to. Any reporter or any political pundit or anybody, you've got to go out there and actually interview people and why they're there. And they are so often ignoring a lot of the noise, a lot of the outrageousness, a lot of the human rights offenses, all of these different things, and they're focusing on very narrow economic issues or in a narrow agendas.
Can I insert something here, in fact, from your Guardian article that I was very struck by, because I often think that this is some part of the equation. Talk about people who say, well, you know, he's a millionaire. I want to be a millionaire. I mean, they see him as almost the paradigm of that.
So I interviewed these two T-shirt vendors who have been following him since 2016, a young white woman and a young African-American man, and they sell all the Trump gear, tons of MAGA hats. And I said, well, I was interviewing them for about 30 minutes. I said, where do you guys get health care? Oh, we don't have health care. We go to the emergency room. I said, well, there's a lot of proposals afoot from, you know, Medicare for All and sort of expanding health care for people like you. And what if it meant taxing the millionaires just a little bit more and you would have health care like most of the industrialized world has? And they say, that doesn't sound very good because, you know, someday soon we're going to be the millionaires. And I thought, well, there it is in a nutshell. That's the American mindset, I think. You know, everybody expects to be a millionaire at some point, so they don't want their future millions taxed in order to get health care.
Talking with Dave Eggers, and he's the founder of San Francisco-based publishing house McSweeney's and co-founder of A26 National, which is a network of youth writing and tutoring centers. His new novel is The Parade. And if you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786. Here's a caller from Tiburon. Jesse, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. That was a really interesting comment that Mr. Eggers just made, that the vendors were worried about their future tax dollars as they're selling MAGA stuff. It's just amazing. But I wanted to bring up a point that I had learned. It's a kind of a theory that Malcolm Gladwell came up. He's got a podcast called Revisionist History, and he did a podcast about the border. And he postulated a theory that the border wall and border security actually add to more immigration, because the theory is behind it in that before there was more security, people would kind of come across the border during the day to work and go back home in the evenings. And it was just kind of circular immigration. It wasn't really immigration. It was just work. And then once they started enforcing the border and making it more secure, it became so difficult to cross that once they came in, they felt it was too much of a challenge to actually go back. So then they just stayed in the United States. And if that theory holds water, then that would mean that building a wall across the entire southern border would actually just add to more immigration. And I'm wondering if you or Mr. Eggers has ever thought about this or talked to people about this idea in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's
interesting, another Trump rally I went to was in Phoenix, and at which afterward all of us were tear gassed by the local police. It was that one went awry. But after that rally, I interviewed Jeff Flake the day after, because I wanted to know. He had just been called out by Trump during this rally. This is when Trump
didn't meet him in an elevator by any chance, like that?
No. I don't know where he was when I called him. But Flake is really interesting on this. He says the exact same thing as the caller does, and that Gladwell pointed out, and he put it in his book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which is actually like a really interesting text if you want to sort of understand the old school conservative mind.
That's Barry Goldwater's title, too.
Yeah. So he's a Goldwater fan and a Reagan fan. But, you know, Flake had was from a ranching family right around the border. So it was the same thing. He said it used to be that, you know, workers would come across the border for the day and work and go back. And then, of course, when the wall started going up, all these families had to make a decision which side of the border they were going to settle on and grow their families in. And so I haven't read Gladwell's article, but there's a lot there to unpack. And I think that for so many reasons, the wall as it's being constructed and with its motivations is such a catastrophically bad idea.
There's a listener who says, when a sociologist from Berkeley wrote a book to explain Trump people in Louisiana, that was Arlie Hochschild, I wondered why LSU didn't send a sociologist to explain us San Francisco people. And here's Barry who says, would Mr. Eggers have some stuff to say about 826 in the Tenderloin? Three cheers.
Yeah, you know, with a lot of help from Supervisor Jane Kim and the city under Mayor Lee, there was an old liquor store called Big Boy Liquor in the Tenderloin, Golden Gate and Leavenworth. It was a blight on this neighborhood. It has so many kids, so many families, like 4,000 kids that live in the Tenderloin. And a friend of mine, Mokhtar Akhundzadeh, who you've met, grew up around the corner. And this was known as just like a bad place, like drugs dealt inside. And the last thing the Tenderloin needs is another liquor store. So the city helped push out this liquor store and helped us arrange a lease to build another 826 center in this former liquor store. And what we found in this building is that, you know, we kept knocking down walls and finding more and more space. So we have about 4,000 square feet of safe haven for kids. It's a writing and tutoring center, but also a podcast studio and all of these other things, publishing center for kids at Golden Gate and Leavenworth. And the city was also helpful and in getting us a new spot in the Mission Bay that just opened a few weeks ago. So right there... There's affordable housing for families above. A lot of formerly homeless families live above. And below, we have a free lease for, well, basically forever, to have a new center there. It has like an enchanted forest theme. So you go there, super incongruous in Mission Bay, which is so, you know, kind of hasn't quite gotten a San Francisco personality, let's say.
It's like, a little stark.
It's a little stark so far. Yeah. But there's a lot of families there, and I think that they're doing it thoughtfully to try to insert a little character in there and make it, you know, accessible to, you know, to some families that are could never pay market rates in that neighborhood. And they're about to build a public school around the corner, too. So, you know,
that's
I'm
great.
A fan of the city, how they sort of go about this, and they're very thoughtful about it, and there's a lot of, you know, I'm a fan of the civil servants in the city that do... They're really trying to do the right thing. And Joaquin Torres helped us a lot. And so it's please go visit either the place in the Tenderloin or in Mission Bay.
Here's a listener named Julie who writes, as a 26-year-old Peace Corps volunteer in Guinea, Bissau, West Africa, I was naive to the purposes of the myriad international groups and their missions during my first year, but I came to believe that most of us were a lot like Dave's healthcare worker. If you were not able to focus solely and passionately on your own job, your personal value system could completely derail your efforts. My students, neighbors, and many other people I was in contact with wanted me to be so much more for them than I was capable of being.
That's well put. Yeah, I think every Peace Corps worker would echo that. And, you know, so many people that work for NGOs. It is so, I have admiration for people that do the work. And I met so many of them, especially in South Sudan. And it's so complex. It's infinitely more complex than anything you think you're going to see when you go to, especially a community that has high need and is coming out of is in a post-conflict zone. And then there's just, you know, I'd say 92% of the outcomes are not what you expect, you know, or the needs are not what you came to do. And I think that the one important thing is humility, because I have a when I, you know, Valentino Deng is a genius of development. He's developed schools throughout South Sudan. He was the minister of education for his region for a while. He's the one that should lead. And us who are coming from the outside should follow because he knows the work. And there are people like Valentino all throughout the world that know what needs to be done on the ground. And we, who sometimes have resources and time to give, need to follow and have the humility to follow. Because every time I tried to help with Valentino's school, I was wrong. Anytime I had an idea, it was naive, impractical, and I had this...
So he taught you some humility, huh?
Well, I thought I came in humble already because I knew I didn't know what his hometown of Mario Bay needed. But every time I did have an idea, little idea, I once had an idea for a toilet. I said, you know, there's no running water and sewage system in Mario Bay, South Sudan. And I said, well, you know, let's design sort of a Western toilet, you know, for the aid workers that come in or, you know, educators that come in from around the world to spend a summer. And I designed it looking like a chimney with like a toilet seat on the, Western toilet seat on the top. And we built it. And the next time I came back, I said, was anyone using this? They said, not really. Why? Well, it's become a home for all the bats in the region. And they love to be underneath it. I don't know. For whatever reason, if you were going to sit on it, you would have a surprise from below, from a legion of bats that had taken up a home. It's just like a comical example of the fact that we do need to always listen to local expertise and local stakeholders, and I think that we have a lot to give in, you know, industrialized countries and that have resources and have wherewithal, but we do need to follow the local expertise and the local community leaders that really know how to do it right. And with that combination, a lot can get done. But I think sometimes our hubris gets in the way.
Often the hubris gets in the way. I also like that image of the bat in the toilet for a movie, you know,
right.
Great comic little episode. I'm going to get to some callers here, more callers here, but I have to ask you, we were talking about Africa, we were talking before about stylists and influences, literary and otherwise, but I was struck by Koetsi's work when I was reading yours, and I wondered if that was, and even Achebe to some extent, do African writers have an effect on you?
Sure, of course, and you can't... I love Achebe, and it's hard to escape his influence. And then when I finished the book, I sent it to a friend of mine, Noel Tong, who also from South Sudan, but he immediately mentioned Waiting for the Barbarians, Coetzee's book, and because it also had sort of unnamed country and vague about its period, and I had not read it. But it's always the books that are close in shape and tone that you haven't read, but others might assume that you've been influenced by, but I loved that book. And I had read so much of Coetzee otherwise, but it happened to be the one that had escaped me. And now I think that they have some genetic similarity.
And here's Darren. Darren, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to reach out to Mr. Eggers and say thank you so much for the work and stuff that your organization put into the children. My daughter, Danielle, was at Oakland Tech a couple years ago, and they did an adaptation from your book, Voices of the Storm.
Yeah.
Voices from the Storm, and did a play. And I'm telling you, just to watch the change and the growth of these kids by the character study of the voices that you brought forth from that. And she's gone on to do social justice in her own theater company, and she's a student at NYU now. So
Whoa. Just
the growth and stuff that you have inspired in these children is amazing. And I just want to say thank you.
Wow.
It's good of you to call.
Well, congratulations on her getting into NYU. Yeah. That is no joke these days. That is...
People are trying to get $50,000 to get an NYU in places.
Well, you know
like
what? He mentions a Voice of Witness, which is our oral history project, which is based in the mission. And there's a new book out just this week about unaccompanied minors coming from Central America and Salita. And there's events actually this week, one tonight at Manny's in the mission, if anybody wants to go and hear from the narrators of the book. Oral history with high school students is, I really feel like it should be almost required, because if you listen to these voices, the book the caller mentioned is Voices from the Storm, is about those that New Orleanians that lived through Hurricane Katrina and suffered a lot of human rights abuses in the process. But oral history as a first person access to history, to sort of events, social tumult and historical moments, there's no better way because it's first person. It's so immediate. The students really grip and grab onto it. And then if you teach the students how to practice oral history or read these narratives or adapt them onto the stage, there's that empathy transference that's so beautiful where they get to sort of be that person and walk in those shoes for a little bit. And so there was a teacher, Lisa Morehouse, at Balboa High School that taught oral history and taught us how to teach it too for a lot of years. That was it's incredible. There's nothing like it. It's the most powerful thing, and it gets – and the caller's daughter going to social justice happens so often when you teach high school students oral history and that sort of access. They get – engaged permanently. So I love to hear that.
Now on that very positive note, we have to conclude. Dave, always good to have you, and congratulations on the parade.
Thank you.
And the parade is out and available, and I'm sorry I can't get to more calls or emails, but thank you, those of you who participated. And remember that we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue online, kqed.org/forum, and for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.